greetings. We are here for part three in this series. If you haven't listened to the previous first two parts, you might want to go back and do that, because I'm not going to backtrack for you. We're talking about the book Datonomics, how dating became a lopsided numbers game. It's written by a guy named John, some last name I can't pronounce, B-I-R-G-E-R. And instead of embarrassing myself by trying to pronounce his name that I can't pronounce, I'm just not saying his last name. Just calling him John. I can pronounce John. I'm watching David Cerini's documentary about Anita Sarkeesian. And you can scream, shout, whine, cry, snivel, piss, moan, look for a safe space. You can shove your opinion up Obama's ass. Wait, no, up your ass. That way Obama's cock has something to keep it company. Whew! You know, I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. But even when I don't know what I'm talking about, I am still right, and you are still wrong. Because it comes naturally to me. I've been doing this since 1999. I've been podcasting for 11 years. I am right. I am always right. I've always been right. I will always be right. I am never wrong. This is Stating the Obvious Podcast. It is the weapons platform from which I launch the cruise missile of my intellect, homes in on and destroys stupid motherfucking status all around the world. The shattering glass, that's been the aftershock, sucks back in after the nuclear explosion and all that air is pushed out. All the air comes rushing back in. And any glass that was on, say, an opposing side of a building that wasn't shattered during the initial nuclear explosion, then the glass gets broken out by the air pressure. I am the Great One himself. I am the founder of the Cynical Libertarian Society. This is Stating the Obvious Podcast. In the control room is the lovely and adorable Randy. You can send us email at God, that's CYNLIBSOC.com. That's God, a dog spelled backwards, G-O-D. We're on the interwebs, CYNLIBSOC.com, on the Twitterverse, until Anita Sarkeesian bans me at CYNLIBSOC.com. Watching David Cerini's documentary about Anita Sarkeesian, it's good so far. I mean, no major complaints, other than, of course, the complaint I have about most videos, movies, whatever, is learn how to fucking normalize the sound. Fuck, Davis. Jesus Christ. It's like in the interviews with the honey badgers, the sound is so low, you have to crank the volume up to hear what the fuck they're saying, and then it changes to the next interview, and the sound on that is so fucking loud it blows my ears out. Can please, people, when you make a fucking documentary, or, and I understand, like, if it's just, you know, your vlog, and you're pulling things out of your ass. I'm not in things like this podcast, right? I'm not, when you're making something you're trying to pass off as a professional product, which the average vlog is not a professional product. I don't make any pretenses that this is a professional product. But when you're putting forth a video or podcast that you are claiming is a professional product, equalize the goddamn audio tracks. Fuck. Other than that, it's pretty good. There's a little too much of this weird computer graphic background shit for when Davis doesn't have any B-roll. I mean, you would think he could have found some fucking B-roll to put in the thing. I don't know. He could put in some clips of fucking titty dancers or, I don't know, fucking kittens. Anything, dude. Just put something that's just fucking stupid computer graphics. But regardless, I mean, Davis is doing a pretty good job so far of making his case, which he does a good job of logically, coherently making his case, even when he's wrong, and he's wrong quite a bit. He is a monarchist, but he does a really good job of making his case and presenting his arguments in a logical, coherent, rational, intelligent manner. So that's why I like him, even though I disagree with him about a whole lot of shit. He's not just screaming about his feelings and needing a safe space and all this other shit. All right, let's pick up with the book. All right, we left off on page 54. And I read this part. I'm going to backtrack one paragraph. All right, here we go. The story changed, though, when women outnumbered men, just as it did in the animal kingdom. When men were the ones in undersupply, women were, quote, more likely to be valued as mere sex objects, unquote, according to Guten Tag and Secord. One upside for everyone was that the quality and variety of sex seemed to improve. Clinical sex studies observed, quote, a real increase in and diversification of erotic activity, unquote, as 20th century gender ratios began to skew female. They wrote, quote, coital frequency and length of intercourse have both increased substantially, as has length of foreplay, unquote. And we all know that size matters. All right. A second upside. Historically, when men were scarce, women were more likely to attain political rights and economic parity. For example, in ancient Sparta, where the ratio of men to women was low, women were highly educated and controlled two-fifths of land and property. For women, however, the advantages associated with too few men did not erase the problem of diminished marriage prospects. In the too many women societies, the culture did not emphasize love and commitment, Guten Tag and Secord concluded. Sex outside of the marriage became the norm, and out-of-wedlock births commonplace. Does that remind you of any society that you might live in today, where sex outside of marriage becomes normal, and out-of-wedlock births become commonplace? Sound familiar? Quote, the outstanding characteristic of times when women were in oversupply would be that men would not remain committed to the same woman throughout her childbearing years, unquote. And why would you? Again, supply and demand. If there's more women than men, there's no reason to get married and stick with the same bitch. More men and women remained single because men had less incentive to settle down. And when couples did marry, they were more likely to get divorced. For men and women alike, sexual libertarianism became the prevailing ethos of the day. Quote, brief liaisons would be usual, as men would have opportunities to move successfully from woman to woman or to maintain multiple relationships with different women. Unquote. Sound familiar? And of course, this is the society you get when women outnumber men. And in our current society, women are, of course, pushing to, femistatist, not women. Because again, remember I said before, the femistatists are a very small portion of the female population. There just appear to be more of them than there actually are because they're so fucking loud and obnoxious. Feminists are pushing to minimize the influence men have on society and minimize the number of men, especially amongst the general population. And by that, I mean concentration camps, except, of course, that we call them prisons. All of the men put into the prison system are not entirely removed from the breeding population and the mating population, because there are female prison guards who have sex with male prisoners. But for the most part, men who are put into prison are removed from the breeding population, the potential dating population. And so this skews the numbers towards females even more. More females, more men. So again, you got more females than men, and you're creating a situation where many of the men who are young and alpha-ish, the type that women would want to fuck, are in prison. So not only do you have more women than men, and thus the women aren't able to find men willing to marry and commit to them, but some of the good quality men are being locked up. Now, I'm not saying every criminal is a good quality man, but again, I'm saying good quality man from the female perspective. Remember, from the female perspective, the criminal is the man she wants to fuck, because the criminal is a man who can impose his will on other people. A criminal is a man who is an alpha male, and she wants the alpha male sperm so that she gets a child that is an alpha male child, which she can then raise to have unquestionable loyalty to her, so that her alpha male criminal child will steal, rape, kill, murder in her favor and support her when she's old. Again, this is not evil. This is called biology, right? Women throughout their existence are parasites. When they're young, they're a parasite on their father. When they're middle age, they're a parasite on their husband, boyfriend, concubine, sleepover, whatever, fuck buddy, whatever you want to call it. When they're old, they're a parasite on their children. Top of that, something else occurred to me as I was thinking about this book and this great dilemma of how there are all these 40-year-old plus women who can't find men to marry them. And of course, I pointed out that these women only want to marry men with college degrees. They only want to marry men that make more money than them. They only want to marry men that are 6'1" or taller. And so right there, you've shrunk your pool so much. I mean, another thing that shrinks the pool of men that these women, who have very high opinions of themselves, which I would argue are very unfounded opinions of themselves, another thing that shrinks their pool is, of course, affirmative action. The fact that companies and corporations and organizations are pushing so hard to give high-paying jobs to women, regardless of whether or not the women deserve it. You know, every time a woman gets an executive job, that's an executive job a man can't have. So by pushing women into all of these jobs, you know, and yes, but they could create more jobs. No, the pie's not unlimited, people. The corporation only has so much money, right? Everybody wants to marry, every woman wants to marry the vice president of a corporation. Okay, so there's, because corporations are evil, but hey, you know, the vice president of the corporation, as long as he's bringing the money home to you, that's not evil, is it? There's only so many vice president slots, and the more of them you pack with women, the fewer of them are packed with men, which means that the number of men good enough for you, 40-year-old women with your college degrees and your careers to marry, gets a little bit smaller. All these things you're doing are making this pool of men that you're willing to date and marry. And we, again, nowhere in the book does it explain at any point that I recall why men should want to marry any of these women. As I said, the entire point of this book is the ways that men should fix themselves so as to make themselves desirable by these 40-year-old educated career women. At no point does anybody present any evidence why a man would want to date, much less marry, a 40-year-old woman who has devoted the previous 20 years of her life to her career. But then again, what men want doesn't really fucking matter in today's feminized society, where the prime directive is that no white woman must ever experience discomfort. All right. Where am I stopping? Page 56. Okay, here we go. For Gutentag, the implications of shifting sex ratios were both historical. She believed the sexual revolution and the feminist movement were fueled by lopsided gender ratios, and personal too. Divorced in her 20s, Gutentag spent much of her adult life as a single mother balancing kids and career. pardon me, that's not in the book. Quote, her first husband walked out on her, unquote, said Susan Salison, one of Gutentag's closest friends. In theory, Gutentag should not have had much trouble remarrying. Again, the delusion. Okay, a man left you, and it says here she's balancing her kids and career. So she's got at least two kids, plural, and the man left her. Either the man left her because she's a bitch, dying, which I know would make a lot of you out there happy, but go fuck yourself, I'm still alive, barely. So the man left her, so either Gutentag is a bitch, or she has really poor choice in men. She chose a shitty man to get married to and have kids with. So either she's a bitch, or she just doesn't have any powers of discrimination. And she's has kids. What in the fuck makes the idiot who wrote this book, John, whose last name I can't pronounce, to think that she should not have much trouble remarrying? How is it that the femistatist and the beta males and the white knights and the orbitals are so fucking incapable of understanding that men, real men, don't want to raise other men's children? Why can somebody explain to me why that is so difficult for women and femisimps and beta male orbitals and white knights to understand? Can anybody explain this to me? According to Salison and others, Gutentag was attractive, kind, charismatic, and brilliant. And she has two kids. And she has two kids. And she has at least two kids. And apparently, either she's a bitch or she has bad choice in people. One of her former research associates at Harvard, Kit Wheatley, said Gutentag was extremely popular with students. Yet dating proved to be a major struggle for Gutentag. More so, it seemed, than for divorcees of her mother's generation. Okay, being popular with college students doesn't make you dating material. If you go back in the podcast way back, one of my professors was very popular with me, Bernard Roland. He's very popular. I liked this guy. I talked about his classes and his teachings extensively. I have some of his books. I'm not interested in dating him. Just because you're popular with students doesn't make you marriage material. There's no connection there. Quote, she had trouble finding another man, unquote, said her son, Michael Gutentag, now a law professor. Quote, I think she was really struck by how poorly the men treated women back then. There seemed to be a lack of chivalry, unquote. No, was it how poorly men treated women? Or was it how poorly men treated single mothers? We're just going to just gloss over this whole part where she has kids. And yet, see, no time. Oh, it's so difficult for this poor woman. Oh, she's so oppressed because no man wants to date her and her kids by another guy that left her. Because either she's a bitch or she's a poor judge of character. one more paragraph to go. In this context, Guttentag's gender ratio-driven theory explains the rise of feminism in the 1960s and 70s has... Okay, I can't read. In this context, Guttentag's gender ratio-driven theory explaining the rise of feminism in the 1960s and 1970s has an almost autobiographical tinge. Yes, it does, because... Blah, I'm dying again. God, I'm going to fucking die today. On the podcast. All right. Yes, autobiographical. Because for women, everything is about them. From the perspective of a woman, as I've said before, if she's not receiving attention, then she doesn't exist. So of course it's autobiographical, because for women, everything is autobiographical. Quote, why, she and Secord wrote, quote, should women in these contemporary times be fighting so hard for power, independence, and equality? Why should they feel that they have been used, manipulated, exploited, and cast aside? Although they are far from having status and power equal to that of men, women have been vastly more oppressed in other times and places than they are in America today. It is only that they are more aware of the inequalities and in a better position to fight for more equal understanding. Or is there something more that contributes to the surge of feminism in these contemporary times? Unquote. Yes, feminism is surging because women, especially white women in North America, don't really have any problems. I mean, they are parasites on the most prosperous and materialistically successful society that has ever existed. Right? Remember, in the sub-Sahara desert, there is no such thing as a microaggression. Right? In a war zone, there's no such thing as a microaggression. When some Muslim piece of shit who believes in Islam, the religion of peace, is raping a 14-year-old girl, that 14-year-old girl isn't really worried about microaggressions. Feminism, femistatism, has emerged full force in the United States because white women in the United States have the easiest lives that have ever been lived by any humans in the entire history of the species. I mean, royalty, you know, kings, the Chinese emperors. Oh, they may have been able to command armies and all this other shit, but, I mean, they had to poop. They didn't have flush toilets. They didn't have toilet paper. They didn't have central air and heating. There is nobody who has had it better than white women in modern North America. They are the most spoiled, pampered, privileged humans that have ever lived. And that's why feminism is erupting, because they have no true hardships in their lives to occupy their time and minds. I mean, why should they feel that they've been used, manipulated, exploited, and cast aside? Because they haven't. Women don't have to go off to war and get killed. Women don't have to do dangerous jobs. Women don't have to pay child support and alimony. Women don't have to go to prison for things that men go to prison for. Women don't have to worry about being accused of rape by somebody you didn't even have sex with and realizing that the person accusing you of rape doesn't even have to present evidence, right? If a woman is on Twitter and somebody tweets at her, she can call it harassment and the person can be banned from Twitter. I mean, there's nothing about the female, white female in North America in 2016 that is fucking used, manipulated, exploited, or cast aside. They are the most privileged group of people. I have in my notes here, at this point, to notice how all of these women, I've really talked about this multiple times already, but it's in my notes to talk about it again. Notice how these women are completely unable to realize they may not deserve a man. It just does not occur to them that they may not be deserving of this man that they think is supposed to show up and want to date them or marry them. To them, and to the white knight, femicent, beta males like John, these 40-year-old women with their children and their careers are entitled to men wanting to date them. They are entitled to a man wanting to marry them. Again, we come back to what I've been saying for however long I've been saying it. Women are objects, not agents. It never occurs to a woman that she has to deserve a man. It never occurs to a woman that she might have to do things. She might have to change things about herself in order to become a person who deserves a man. From the perspective of a woman, she is simply an object. She is an object, and she deserves a man. Even though a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle, she deserves a man simply by virtue of her existence. And until you can figure out that's not how the world works, you're going to continue standing around wondering why in the fuck nobody wants to date you and your three children and your $80,000 of student loans that you still have to pay off even though you've been paying on your student loans for 20 years. Okay, page 58. Second paragraph, next page. Now listen to this. Hawaii has 17% more men than women aged 20 to 34 thanks to its 11 U.S. military bases. Not coincidentally, Hawaii boasts a marriage rate for women that is 5 percentage points higher than the national average. More men than women, higher marriage rate. Okay. Gee, who would have predicted that? All right. Evolutionary psychologist Neil Barber discovered that countries with high ratios of men to women have lower teen pregnancy rates. In another study, Barber analyzed crime data from Interpol and found a correlation between low numbers of men and high rates of sexual assault. Elevated rape rates were, quote, a predictable feature of countries with a relative scarcity of men, unquote, according to Barber. Robert O'Brien, a sociology professor at University of Oregon, studied U.S. crime data and reached the same conclusion. Drawing on Gutentag and Secord, O'Brien theorized that men are more likely to, quote, protect their women, unquote, when women are in short supply. Supply and demand. Where have we heard of that before? Oh, yes, from those evil anarcho-capitalists. Gutentag and Secord had noted that the punishment for rape in ancient Greece was far harsher in city-states with oversupplies of men versus those with oversupplies of women. Death in Athens compared to a monetary fine in Sparta. Given the recent spat of high-profile campus rape cases, Barber and O'Brien's research begs the question of whether college's lopsided sex ratios may be indirectly contributing to a rise in campus sexual assaults. It's a question that universities with big gender imbalances should surely be investigating. Fewer men, more women. Women become less valuable to the men because there's an oversupply. Thus, men become more likely to rape women because women are viewed as less valuable. Gosh, it makes so much sense. It must be the patriarchy. You know what this is? This is just white men trying to oppress women. There can't possibly be any such thing as supply and demand. That just could not possibly be real. At colleges with 60 to 40 ratios, women to men were significantly more likely to be sexually active and significantly less likely to go out on more than 6 traditional dates during their college careers versus merely hooking up. Yes. All right. In my notes, this is where I'm supposed to remind you that this is why I call this podcast Stating the Obvious. Good thing I have notes, so I know the fuck I'm doing. This is where I have in my notes to remind you that, yes, women cost money. No, I'm reading the wrong note. That's coming up. Women do cost money, though. So I'm supposed to remind you, supply and demand. When we have fewer men, men call the shots because they're in demand. When we have fewer women, women call the shots because they're in demand. Supply, demand. You can't fucking get around it. You can make all the laws. You can legislate. You can have Anita Sarkeesian on Twitter banning things she doesn't like that offend her because she's fat. It doesn't fucking matter. Supply and demand in biology will always take precedent over laws, political correctness, tolerance, diversity, multiculturalism, all this other bullshit will always take precedence. Page 64. Last full paragraph, last line. What is this? According to Watkins and his co-authors, a women's shifting perception of attractiveness, not only for men, but for other women as well, appeared to be an evolutionary adaptation that promotes, quote, efficient allocation of mating effort, unquote. This adaptation reduces, quote, within-sex competition, unquote, among women by decreasing their sensitivity to male looks and by increasing women's sensitivity to, quote, the quality of potential competitors, unquote, at times when women are plentiful. The end result, women are more likely to settle for less attractive mates when competition from other women is intense, and more likely to hold out for attractive men when female competitors are fewer. When female competitors are fewer, women hold out for more attractive men. How might this relate to our society today? Well, female competitors for quality men are indeed getting fewer because more and more women are fat, more and more women are ugly, more and more women have tattoos and piercings and shave their heads. More and more women have liberal arts degrees. More and more women are Democrats. More and more women are shrill femistatist. More and more women have children, even though they're not married. And so there is less female competition for the good men, because all of these women are just automatically the good, the quality, the alpha male men look at all of these women and just laugh. They're not going to have anything to do with that. And thus, the women become more likely to hold out for more attractive men. And of course, there are fewer attractive men as men become fatter, stupider, get liberal arts degrees, vote Democrat, have large amounts of debt, are femisimps, so forth and so on. So the pool, and I've talked about this a million, you know, the pool of both quality women and quality men is really fucking small. And when you toss into that anybody's unrealistic standards, male or female, in this case that we're talking about females, so when you have a small pool of attractive women and you have this 40-year-old woman with her kids and her career, and she's not as attractive as she thinks she is. First of all, she's not in the attractive pool. She's not in the pool that is attractive to the quality men. But she thinks she deserves the quality man. And the pool of quality men is really small. And as I keep saying to you, the quality men who are 40 years old and her age and make enough money and have enough education that she's willing to date them, they're dating 26-year-olds. They're not looking to have sex with a 40-year-old bimbo like her. But of course, women can't possibly have anything to do with this. This is all part of the patriarchy. Some of the more intriguing new research on gender ratios takes Gutenberg's theories beyond sex, love, and dating. Remember Ackerman, the MIT professor, in a 2012 article published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology? Ackerman, Vladis, and I'm going to mutilate that name, I'm not even going to try, of University of Minnesota, and four other researchers raised an interesting question. Why do Columbus, Georgia, and Macon, Georgia, two cities a mere 100 miles apart with a shared heritage and similar economies, have such drastically different spending habits? Columbus has one of the highest consumer debt rates in the country, while Macon has one of the lowest. I lived in Columbus, Georgia for 3 years while I was in the military. Average consumer debt in Columbus is $3,479 per person, higher than it is in Macon. Ackerman and his colleagues suspected this difference had something to do with sex ratios. Brace yourselves. Trigger warning. This is going to be offensive. Macon has 0.0. No, god damn it. Fuck. I need a drink of tea. Fucking Christ, my brain is not working today. Macon has 0.78 single men for every single woman, while Columbus has 1.18 single men for every single woman. Now, for those of you who can't do math, Macon has more women than men. Columbus has more men than women. Ackerman's study does not explain why the two cities' sex ratios are so different, but there is one obvious explanation. Columbus is home to Fort Benning, the third largest army base in the country. And though not part of the study, the oversupply of men in Columbus does appear to affect marriage and divorce in precisely the ways Gutentag anticipated. Compared to Macon, marriage rates in Columbus are much higher and divorce rates much lower. According to census estimates for 2012, 36% of women aged 20 to 34 are married in Columbus versus just 19% in Macon. Additionally, 3% of Columbus women in that age bracket are now divorced versus 6% in Macon. How far am I going with this? Page 66, first paragraph. The biggest question Ackerman and his colleagues wanted to explore was whether sex ratios could influence spending and saving to the same extent they influence marriage and divorce. The answer was yes, because men put more effort into dating women when women are scarce, and also because, quote, mating effort is associated with impulsivity, unquote. Ackerman and his colleagues predicted that people living in cities with higher ratios of men to women would own more credit cards and carry more debt. They gathered sex ratio statistics for 120 U.S. cities, compared them to regional financial data on credit cards and consumer debt. Turned out that men were indeed more financially impulsive when they had to compete. Quote, a relative abundance of single men in America was related to both owning more credit cards and having a higher amount of debt. Women cost money. That's where that was written in my notes. Again, stating the obvious here. If there are fewer women than men, men have to compete more against other men to get the good women. If you're competing for a woman, the way you compete for a woman is by giving her free stuff, because that's what women want. The way you give a woman free stuff is by spending money. And the more you have to compete, because there's fewer women, the more money you're going to spend, and the more money you spend, the more likely you are to run up debt. Supply, demand, biology. Stating the obvious, people. Stating the fucking obvious. But you have to be told this, and there are those of you out there who I'm sure are denying that this could even be true. When women are rare, they are valuable. When women are not rare, they are not valuable. Again, so what do we see here? We see when women are rare, men are more willing to go into debt to get the good women. When women outnumber the men, men are more likely to rape women because women are perceived as being of less value. I know, you. Everybody has equal value, tolerance, diversity, multicultural. Nope, sorry, no. Nope. Reality does not give a fuck about any of that shit. Supply, demand, biology. Page 68. Very last paragraph. No, God, I can't fucking read my own notes. Page 68, first full paragraph. The fuck? Page 68, first full paragraph. Let me just fucking read it. In 2007, a 2007 paper by behavioral psychologist Thomas Pollitt and Daniel Nettle of Newcastle University in the UK provided further evidence of women favoring wealthy men when men are in oversupply. Jesus, there's a fucking statement of the obvious. No wonder I had that in the notes to read. First line, then page 69... last paragraph. Oh, God, here we go. blah, blah, blah. Do I need to read all this in between? Yes, I do. Okay, here we go. This is I find my place. Paulette Nettle analyzed American census data and concluded that in communities that were 52.5% male, low-earning men were 2.3 times less likely to find a wife as compared to lower-earning men living in communities that were 50% male. Paulette Nettle's finding is timely as the non-college educated dating pool in the U.S. is now 53% male. This may explain why marriage rates for non-college educated women are higher than they are for non-college educated men. That's also explained by the fact that men do not give a fuck if a woman has a college education. Furthermore, many men would prefer to marry a woman who doesn't have a college education because you don't have to listen to their arrogance and their nagging and their bitching and deal with their fucking attitude. Among those age 22 to 29 who are without a college degree, 30% of women were married in 2012 versus 22% of men, according to census data. All right, another timely study on the economic impact of lopsided gender ratios concluded that an oversupply of men has been an important driver behind one of the world's greatest economic success stories. The paper Sex Ratios, Entrepreneurship, and Economic Growth in the People's Republic of China argued that China's draconian one-child policy, a policy that left China with a massive oversupply of men thanks to sex selection, abortion, female infanticide, and foreign adoption of Chinese girls, has been an overlooked contributor to the nation's phenomenal GDP growth. Yes, if you don't have women to occupy your time, you do other productive stuff. Again, stating the obvious here. The China Studies authors, whose names I can't pronounce, a finance professor at Columbia Business School, and guy who's an economist with the International Food Policy Research Institute, understand their argument might sound far-fetched. Only to stupid people would this sound far-fetched. Intelligent people are right on board. They wrote, Robert M. Swallow, the Nobel Prize printer for his pioneering work on the theory of educational growth, once said, everything reminds Milton Friedman of the money supply. Well, everything reminds me of sex, but I keep it out of the paper. Unquote on that. Well, Solo might have been missing something economically significant by not linking sex with economic growth. Wei and Zhang's thesis was similar to Angenstrie's. In a society such as China's, with 122 men for every 100 women, women have more economic bargaining power when it comes to marriage. And that means young men and their parents must accumulate greater wealth in order to impress and secure a bride. Chinese women are not shy about exploiting the lopsided conditions, as the Los Angeles Times reported in 2010. Quote, I would rather cry in a BMW than smile on the back of my boyfriend's bicycle, unquote. The story quoted one Chinese bachelorette. Again, what have I said about women? They're not going to marry a man who rides the bus. China, America, it doesn't matter. She'd rather cry in a BMW than be happy on a bicycle, because it's all about how can I get a man with the most resources? How can I get somebody who will make a suitable parasitical host for me to parasite on? A personal ad from another. Quote, I'm 25 years old, looking for a boyfriend. I want you to have an apartment and a car. The apartment has to be built after 2000, and the car has to be better than a minivan. Unquote. That is a single woman in China making her demands in a personal ad. For what she wants from the man, she's going to date, fuck, marry. Again, all women are like that, boy. All women, American, Chinese, doesn't matter. They are all out to get the most quality man that's going to give them the most free resources. And that's biology. That's not necessarily evil. The reason these 40-year-old women with their kids and their careers can't get a quality man is because the quality men are also looking for quality. And again, I know I just keep saying this over and over and over because it's the response to this book. And it's the thing that he never talks about. The 40-year-old woman with her three kids and her career wants to find some 44-year-old man with a lot of money and an education to marry her because she thinks she is deserving of this. And I don't know how many times I have to fucking tell you. The 44-year-old guy with the money and the college education is dating the 26-year-old. He is also looking for a quality woman. And the problem here is that the 40-year-old bitch with the kids and the career, she is not the quality woman to the man she thinks is a quality man. And it is her inability to figure this out and to accept this that is causing the problems alongside with the lopsided gender ratios. Yes, the lopsided gender ratios absolutely factor into it. But the female inability to understand math, to understand supply and demand, and to take any responsibility for herself, who she is, what she's done, and to change herself to become a quality person, that right there is ultimately more important than the gender ratio. I made it through the podcast without dying. See how it goes next time.